Talking Ball. What was that you said?
Texas Talking Ball.
Gonna hoop upside your head.
Texas Talking Ball.
Tell me who can.
This is Talmadge Heflin, the director of the Center for Fiscal Policy at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. You're listening to the Texas Tribune's weekly podcast. From Driftwood, Texas, where Salt Lick Barbecue is king, here is your host, Reeve Hamilton.
Thank you. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton from Austin with the Tribcast for the first week of November. Joining me is executive editor Ross Ramsey.
Are you a Driftwood hater? Is that the deal?
No, I love Driftwood. All right. I'm just not there. Sadly, I would much rather be there at the Salt Lick than here with you.
Great. Glad to be here, too.
Or with editor Emily Ramshaw.
I'm being patched in from the Bahamas right now. I decided to skip election night.
We can all dream. Speaking of dreams, Ben Philpott, host of Agenda Texas for KUT and the Texas Tribune, is also joining us.
I think we should say high above Austin, considering the floor that we're on here.
Oh, you're
no
high?
The floor. No, the
what,
floor.
Jeez,
been to the Colorado Clinic or something?
No, we're on the 14th floor of this building. It's
he was
oh,
already
mind.
Telling us he was high on all the water that he drank last night to celebrate Prop 6.
Yes, after Prop 6,
and the 4-hour shower.
I drank 3 liters of water and let my sinks run all night long.
What a nice segue right into our first topic. Why waste time with banter or anything?
Why waste time in an election? These things just flew through. Everything was like, okay, whatever. Yeah, fine.
So we're recording
Ross
this.
Ross was calling our elections by 8:15.
Exactly. Before somebody said, the pizza didn't even get cold yet.
We're recording this on Wednesday, which is just hours after Election Day.
And we didn't eat pizza on election night. Yeah, we're way too refined for that. And
you so, didn't eat pizza?
No, no
losers.
That's only KUT eats pizza.
We
on
had
election
five
night.
Pizzas.
I think everyone does.
Well, we had Korean food.
So did any news come out of the out of
you
the
wonder
thing,
why
you know,
people don't like the mainstream
surprises?
Media.
people really Sorry. Went for that airplane parts proposition.
Oh yeah.
I mean, the voters liked everything on the ballot. They didn't, a lot of times voters will skip over things that give people exemptions from taxes. There were a couple of things that gave exemptions to veterans and veterans' widows and veterans' surviving spouses, and you would expect those things to pass. Those are sympathetic. But the thing, inventory for aircraft parts, that's the kind of thing voters often wrinkle their noses at. They said fine to that. They did turn down things that spent money in locations around Texas. So Katy is not getting its $69 million high school football stadium. And the Astrodome.
Sayonara to the Astrodome.
Right, the Astrodome.
Think of all the airplane parts you could store in that football stadium.
Think of all the Astrodome. I guess you could play the Katy football team in the Astrodome.
Oh my gosh, genius!
Out, right?
Yeah, they should just do a trade.
So the bond issue for the Astrodome, turning it into a convention center, $217 million, didn't pass.
And now Miley Cyrus is going to come in on her wrecking ball and tear the whole thing down.
Right. Anise Parker
pop culture
got a third
reference.
Term without a runoff. Yeah.
All of our listeners are far too old to know what that is.
Ben is like a human hashtag over here.
He's got teenage daughters. Teenage daughters.
High hashtag. I like this.
They're not allowed to watch Miley
but there
or
weren't
listen
really
to Miley Cyrus.
Is this because the leaders of the state, like Perry and Strauss, and were just so good at selling Prop 6, or was it really ever in danger?
I think that's the kind of issue that can get knocked off of a ballot pretty easily. If the people who were against it, led vocally by people like Deborah Medina, had been organized about it and had really gone after it in a methodical way, that's the kind of an amendment you can knock off. This would take $2 billion out of the rainy day fund, which has somehow become a sacred account, and put it into a revolving fund that would allow people to borrow and take out credit for projects on water. And one of their questions was, well, who's going to be doing these projects and who's going to get rich on this, yada, yada, yada. That's the kind of thing you can build a negative campaign out of.
I really think there was never a chance that this was going to go down. I mean, for the last 3 years, all we've been seeing in Texas is imagery of, lakes with cracked mud bottoms. And I mean, I just feel like everything that we've been hearing and seeing is what dire straits we're in. I guess I feel like that message permeated.
Well, I agree. But at the same time, the last few elections have shown us that if somebody has an ideological argument, it can trump it can trump maybe what, you know, the other side is, even maybe the more factual side of the argument. And, you know, having different Tea Partiers kind of show up and say, you shouldn't vote for this. I mean, that's worked in kicking out incumbents all across the state. Of course, there you're actually able to also campaign against a person as opposed to just, you know, the need for water in the state.
Well, speaking of a person, there was this, you know, anxiety that Houston might play an outsized influence in deciding that, and that, you know, because they have a mayor's race, they had a mayor's race, you know, maybe all these folks would turn out for the mayor's race, people who have a lot of water in Houston, which is very lush, you know, and that this would die. But I think as a result, maybe of that, you know, enhanced turnout, this had a better shot than it did, especially with all those people turning out to vote for Ernie.
Something
Parker.
Like 12% of the yes votes came from Harris County, something like that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it turned out that voters this time, instead of being price sensitive as they have on other elections, on some of the Tea Party stuff, on bond issues and things like that, instead of being price sensitive, they were, in this case, product sensitive. They were worried, like mm-hmm. you say, about water and, you know.
They were worried about water, but maybe not so much worried about a new football stadium. I was kind of surprised that the Hidalgo Hospital District kind of sailed through. I mean, again, that's a very localized thing, but the entire state gets to vote on a tax increase, essentially.
Well, and there was a huge drop-off in votes. It was interesting. You know, just 9 amendments on the thing. It's not like you're going to be in the booth very long. And last time I looked, 115,000 or 120,000 fewer people voted on the Hidalgo County bond thing than on the... Hmm.
Yeah, it seems to me like once you start checking the yes boxes, you might as well just go the whole way through the list.
Yeah. I mean, like, where on a ballot, you could actually hold your breath
the
whole
like,
time.
Who gets to number 7 and decides, I'm really tired of voting? Like, let's just press go.
I'm exhausted, man.
Yeah.
I usually take a nap after the 6th proposition and get back on it. Isn't there a lingering concern, getting back to Prop 6 for a second, that it's sort of a Band-Aid on a much larger problem and that we could come around and need to solve water in a more comprehensive way and people will say, oh, didn't we already do that?
Yeah. I mean, there's that, and it's also the first in a series of Band-Aids. You know, the TxDOT has this great statistic that it costs $4 billion additional money to maintain the current level of congestion on highways. We haven't messed with that yet. There's a $1 billion bond election or $1 billion in funding for highways on the ballot for a year from now. And that legislature will come back in and talk about $4 billion to $5 billion to, you know, keep the current level of congestion. So that's one. The water stuff that you mentioned, if you include public ed and things like that in infrastructure things, we've got – those are in court. There are a lot of big ticket items coming up for the next legislature.
Look, and if you're going to be rah-rah about all the jobs that you're, you know, quote-unquote luring to Texas, all the people who are coming here, all the population growth, I mean, how – these guys, these legislators really have to be out fighting for these kinds of propositions.
Right. Well, and then if Jay were here, he'd get into a whole thing about is population growth really something we want?
Luckily, Jay's not here.
Yeah, so we can just move on. But speaking of
and I think he's done procreating too, so think.
Well, we won't get into that at all. Speaking of turnout, though, weren't we supposed to see a lot of problems with the implementation of the voter ID law and that, you know, that's been sort of cast by some as a voter suppression effort? It didn't seem to suppress too many votes, except for maybe on the once you got further down the ballot and people started tailing off.
Right. You know, part of the answer to this is we don't completely know yet. It doesn't appear to have done that much. You know, I mean, there were glitches and, you know, it's a new procedure and there's always glitches with a new procedure regardless of how it works. You know, nobody's had time to do any kind of analysis on what it did in this election. And, you know, this to be fair, this isn't the kind of election where people are, you know, clamoring to get in. You're going to have to go through a primary and a general election to see what the real effects of this are. We don't know yet. I mean, that means both sides are open. That's not really taking a side in this thing. It's just you haven't really had you've had sort of a procedural test to see how this works and to see how, you know, what they do when you don't have the right name on your driver's license or whatever. But you haven't seen really a good analysis of whether this is actually keeping some population from voting or not.
And both sides are going to use whatever statistics do come out of this for, you know, future court cases. Mm-hmm. You know, Republicans or the state rather will say, look, it was not a big deal. Everybody got through. Yeah, some people had to do a little affidavit. That was easy enough. Blah, blah, we're done. And Democrats will come back with their own statistics, probably maybe a little more localized and not as general of where they saw problems.
Is the Can I ask just a question about the affidavits? Does the affidavit constitute a problem? I mean, I think there's been some, you know, the language has been used around here. People have been saying, well, there may not have been problems per se, but these affidavits were problematic. I mean, do the affidavits hinder you from being able to vote in any way? I mean,
they appear to slow things down a little bit. I mean, a lot of what was noisy this time. You know, and I really don't even want to characterize it beyond that. Well, a lot of what sort of caused any consternation this time was just a little bit of a hassle about, you know, well, my driver's license has my middle name on it and my voter registration card doesn't. So sign this thing and say you're the same person and then we'll let you vote. It's not even a provisional vote. It counts. Right. It just takes a second. Yeah. You know, if you're looking to go into a voting place and argue with people, there's your material. But
right. There was some guy in Fort Worth who ripped up his registration card in protest.
Right. Yeah, anger management class for voters. Right.
That's really not going to help you vote if that's really your ultimate goal. Yeah.
Right.
But I think I was sort of speaking to that and speaking to Ben's point about statistics. I don't really think statistics have ever played much of a role in the debate on voter ID. You know, no one really had to prove that voter fraud was a problem in order to get the law passed.
Well, that's true.
And now the opponents of voter ID don't seem to they are relying more on anecdote and sort of specific individuals having trouble rather than obviously I think most people probably didn't have much of a problem. But, you know, Jim Wright not being able to vote got a lot of attention.
Right.
Not being able to vote or having to sign an affidavit?
He didn't even get to the voting booth with this thing. He went to the DPS to get a registration card, and he didn't have the right information. He had to go back and get it with his birth certificate or something. Mm. He got it. He did vote, you know, but it was just a hassle. The real question on this, the broad sense question is going to be—
Jim Wright, we should say, is the—
former Speaker of the United States House, former representative, U.S. representative from Fort Worth.
And if you've ever flown Southwest out of Dallas Love Field—
That's right. The Right
Rule. The Right Amendment is named for him, yes.
You know, the real question on this is whether it, you know, hinders some population that has been voting from voting, keeps people from voting. We don't know that yet.
This is very local for those of you who are in Central Texas, but we had some flooding just last week in one part of Travis County, and I was talking to the county clerk here about the idea of, well, you know, some of these people, they literally woke up at 3 a.m. and evacuated their home with, you know, in their pajamas and have not been able, they don't know where their driver's license is, they don't know where anything is. So how can they vote? And the county clerk said, well, there actually was no provision put in the voter ID law for some instance like this of a natural disaster wiping out your ability to actually go and get any kind of ID to be able to go and vote. So that may be something that I don't know if in terms of a court case, but that may be something that they would revisit
in the next session. Well, they could probably cast a provisional ballot.
Mm-hmm. They could. And DPS did finally, I think, came out Wednesday, today, well, the day we're recording this, to start issuing new driver's license. So, but again, these are people who the most important thing to them is you know, tearing up their homes and trying to rebuild and find all their personal stuff and not spending an extra few hours down, you know, correcting a provisional ballot.
And making sure they always have presentable pajamas ready to go.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Speaking of local issues, just for a second, how sad should we be about the demise of the Astrodome?
Well, you know, the eighth wonder of the world, just, you know... Didn't get used. I saw in one of the stories that it hasn't been used for anything since 2009, which is really sort of surprising. Mm-hmm.
Didn't they blow up the Dallas Cowboys stadium too?
They did, but it wasn't domed. I think, and it also was
it had that hole in it.
No, but it also wasn't exactly near anything. I mean, I think
No. The Cowboys Stadium?
Not well, but
was
what
totally
I,
near things.
But what I mean is, it wasn't near.
They replaced it also, right?
In Arlington.
Ben's worried about Reliant Stadium.
No, it was. You know, I think you could make an argument that they were trying to turn that section around Reliant Stadium and everything into really, you know, super gigantic mega convention area. And you know, out in Irving, I mean, you're going to make that a convention center out in the middle of the two interstates. I mean,
Grapevine. I mean, there's tons of stuff out there. I don't know. I just wonder why this is, you know, why is this the eighth wonder of the world versus—
Because that's what they called it.
Because it was domed, multi-use thing.
They invented fake grass for it. AstroTurf.
20 years ahead of all the other ones.
Just like, remember how VCRs were so great? It's like that.
I thought Betamax was great. Yeah,
right.
The ninth wonder of the world. I've heard all about them. I read about them in books.
That's right.
Books have stayed around, though.
Do you feel sad about the Astrodome?
I did have a birthday party at the Astrodome 2009. Yeah.
That was the last event. After that, they said, forget it. We're done.
Sometime in the early 90s when it was still quite wonderful. But I don't really feel that upset about it. But I understand other people do.
I there was no, other than like a couple of Nolan Ryan no-hitters, I don't know that there was any amazing baseball events that happened there.
There were some great baseball events there. The Astros and the Mets series, there was a bunch of great stuff going on there. I mean, there was a bunch of baseball. There were a bunch of concerts. There were a bunch of rodeos. It's been sort of a center of civic life in Houston for long time.
And was it the Billie Jean King Battle of the Sexes tennis match there?
Nobody knows.
I think
only
it was.
Wikipedia knows the answer.
Ross
to that.
Said a lot of great rodeos happened.
This is a good. They had a sale last weekend, I believe. They sold off about 500 pair of
chairs,
bleacher seats, and they sold them for $200 for the pair. So $100 a seat. But
is that how that math works?
Thank you. And
this is why all the kids should have to take Algebra 2.
That's right. Now they're going to have a whole lot more seats that they can sell off because they're going to empty that thing out to blow it up. So they sold out, really. They had like a line. It was like people were lining up for Franklin's barbecue.
So it's not like they could come back to voters next time around and say, okay, this time we want to try this.
Well, in Austin that happens. That happens often in Austin.
Well, I mean, now we want to make a parking lot.
Yeah, right.
I'm sure they're going to look at it and say, okay, here's the price of tearing it down. Does anybody have a better offer and go from there?
Mm-hmm.
And, what they were talking about doing, because the Reliant Stadium is right next to it and can be converted pretty easily into convention space, if the dates are right, was putting two or three or four hotels inside the Astrodome along with some convention space. There's another facility next to those two stadiums that can also be used. And you could turn it into a big convention center. So there is a profit motive here. And if they can figure out how to make the money work, they haven't torn it down yet.
But there are a number of the seven wonders of the world. They don't all still exist. Some wonders leave us.
Oh, are you saying the podcast is over?
Reeve's still mad that they couldn't pass that bond issue on the Hanging Gardens of Babylon.
Yeah,
that's right. Let's move on, shall we? We're rolling out the University of Texas, Texas Tribune poll this week. I think probably the most headline-grabbing thing we've seen so far was the Wendy Davis Greg Abbott matchup for governor potentially.
So the poll found Greg Abbott at 40 and Wendy Davis at 35 and Kathy Glass, a libertarian, at 5. And it's not a prediction of how the thing's going to go. It's just sort of an indication of where things are now. And because they haven't really advertised yet and they haven't really campaigned in earnest yet, what you're looking at really is a lot of name ID. Statewide officials, if they're not the governor, really aren't that well known. And we've forgotten because, Rick Perry's been governor for so long that the number of people in Texas who don't know who he is minuscule. For everybody else, for the David Dewhursts and the Greg Abbotts and all the other statewides, a lot of people don't know who they are, and that's reflected to some extent in Greg Abbott's numbers. Wendy Davis has been, if nothing else, sort of a media star since her filibuster this summer. She's been in the news a lot, and her name ID has jumped dramatically from our June poll to now. So
this is all those Texans reading Vogue.
Exactly.
So what you're seeing really here is a reflection of name ID. The numbers in the governor's race don't match the numbers of people who identify themselves as Republicans and Democrats. And what tends to happen, all other things being equal, what tends to happen is as a campaign goes on, the numbers will start to look more and more like these are Republicans, these are Democrats, these are Abbotts, these are Davises. And then the campaigns, I guess we're going to look at, somewhere between $40 and $65 million in the governor's race on both sides. And that's going to determine a lot about what it looks like in a year.
Is that 35% though? Isn't that very close to the baseline of Democrats?
It is, but it's not. The Democratic statewide candidates have pulled between 37% and 43% for the most part. A couple of outliers either way. For the last 20 years, you can outperform that a little bit. You can underperform it a little bit. It'll fall somewhere in there. Republicans have done better. So if you were looking at, a final ballot, a Democrat typically lands in the low 40s, and a Republican typically lands in the mid to high 50s. Yeah. So Abbott, by that standard, is underperforming, and you would expect those numbers to change as the year goes on.
It left 25% who had not made their minds up yet, right?
Right?
So who are these undecided voters? Even a year out, even, you know, this far out, who are these people who don't have their minds made up?
I think there are people who haven't thought about making up their minds. I don't mm-hmm. think that it's that they can't make up their minds or that they're indecisive. I think it's that, you know, I really haven't thought about that. I haven't really looked at these two. I don't really know them that well. I haven't really considered that decision. It's like asking somebody what they'll order for dinner tomorrow night. I haven't really thought about it. I'm not hungry.
I also don't – I think there does get to be a point – you know, we always have that as you get closer and closer to election day where people are still undecided and you're like, this is ridiculous. You know, everything has been vetted and out there. But at this point, I mean, we're pretty far out. I mean, I don't know what Wendy Davis's positions are on a number of things. Probably same with Greg Abbott. He's mostly just been suing the Obama administration for the last few years.
Right.
It's just such a polarized state that I have a really hard time believing that anybody doesn't know at this point whether they're going to vote Democratic or Republican.
I think if you ask him the generic question, are you going to vote Democratic or Republican, then you'll get the numbers that you expect. And in fact, when we ask people to identify themselves, those are the numbers we got.
Right.
And so what you're asking here, like I said, is a little bit of do you know who these people are? What are your feelings about them? We did not push. You know, when you get close to an election, you take the people who say, I haven't decided, and you say, well, if you had to decide, what would you do? And because we're a year out, we didn't push this time.
Do you think the Kathy Glass effect right now is about spot on, or do you think it will grow or shrink?
You know, Libertarian candidates usually get 3 to 5%.
Mm-hmm.
That's usually the, you know, none of the above vote.
Right.
Right.
But what do we attribute to, like, you know, every now and then you get one that an independent candidate, I guess, that sort of really shakes things up, like a Deborah Medina or like a Kinky Friedman in 2006 could have done if things hadn't sort of gone off the rails a little bit. Does a Libertarian not have that same potential?
Not necessarily. I mean, they, you know, a lot of what happens here is a Libertarian, because they don't tend to be known names, are where you kind of go when you want to park your vote. You know, I can't vote for the Democrat and I can't vote for the Republican for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. What's happened with the independent candidates that you're talking about, the Kinky Friedmans and the Deborah Medinas, is that they were well-known and sort of involved in the campaign as voices. And they weren't just a parking place for a no vote. They attracted votes of their own. The Libertarian vote tends to be, you know, people who vote Libertarian and people who say, well, I'm not going to vote for either of those major party candidates.
So what else have we seen in the polls so far that sort of piqued your interest?
Yeah, tell us about Cruz and Perry.
Yeah, Ted Cruz did great. Ted Cruz's, you know, numbers look great.
These are presidential.
I was going to say he's a Republican senator from Texas, for those who don't know.
If you've got the name ID problem, right.
Right. If you listen to this podcast, you probably don't have that problem.
So the last time we polled the presidential race, Cruz was in first and Perry was in fourth. Perry had 10% in that poll. Cruz had 25%. Marco Rubio and Rand Paul were between them. This time, Cruz is up to 40. Rubio and Paul have fallen out. Perry's still at 10. He's number two. And our poll went into the field the day after the federal shutdown ended. So
Good timing.
Yeah, so it ends up being pretty good timing. And you can look at this and say, well, you know, what did Ted Cruz do to himself with that long talk and with his role in all of this? He had some backlash, and it was all on the Democratic side.
What?
I love doing that to you.
Yeah.
Damn it. Say something else. Let me swat. My fly swatter is right here. It was all Democrats. So if you look at his numbers, Democrats really, really don't like him. Republicans like him pretty well, 52, 53, 54%, something like that. And the Tea Party voters love him, 92% to 2%. So
his
name
ID
went up a little bit, mostly with Democrats, and that's where the negatives came from. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't courting those people.
Yeah.
Do the Republicans like him more post-shutdown than they did before? Do we know that?
Don't know the answer to that.
Okay. It's interesting that the other Republicans might have dropped out of the presidential race, but Perry would have stayed in. Is that just a virtue of because it's a Texas poll?
But if you think about what kind of candidates they are, you know, is Ted Cruz, if I leave Rand Paul or I leave Marco Rubio, where am I likely to land? Mm-hmm. And in this poll, they landed with Ted Cruz.
Chris Christie in this poll?
He's back right behind Perry somewhere. Christie and Jeb Bush were right behind Perry. So what you see is the, whatever you want to call these guys, the insurgent Republicans, the, you know, anti-establishment Republican votes, are migrating or appear to be migrating in Texas in this poll from Paul and Rubio to Cruz.
And I mean, it is important, though,
Texas.
In Texas.
Right.
Right. It is in Texas.
So are they migrating or is this just a logical?
Well, the people who said in June that they were with those guys, you know, appear now to be with Cruz.
Yeah. Well, he's become the star. I mean, he was already the Texas senator, but he's
potential candidate now, right?
Right. He took up all the spotlight in the time immediately before the poll. So it would make sense that if you're thinking Tea Party insurgent, that's the first name that's going to pop into your head, especially in Texas.
But the bottom line here is that, you know, the things that Ted Cruz did nationally that got him attention for better or for worse, at least in terms of his own voters here in Texas, were for better.
Yeah. Did we poll people's feelings on Canada?
We did not.
So we don't know what role that plays.
We have no idea.
Thanks
for asking, though.
You can recommend that for the next poll.
I will sneak that in there. From Ben?
I was just going to say, is it surprising at all that Dewhurst was still leading? Of course, again, this is just the name ID race, I guess, but that Dewhurst was still leading in the lieutenant governor's race?
Well, he's got 26%, and the combined votes for Patterson and Patrick and Staples were 28%. So not Dewhurst is beating Dewhurst by about 2 points. So David Dewhurst's game here has got to be to get out of a March primary without a runoff.
Right.
Because if he goes into a runoff, then he's got a challenge.
Well, we saw what happened to that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Among the others, you know, in this race, Patrick's leading, but it's pretty tight. Patrick at 13, Patterson at 10, Staples back at 5. The margin of error on that's about 5 points. So,
Patrick better spend a little more time on John Corona's airplane.
Right.
Do you want to explain the context of that comment?
Oh, just that John Corona has said, Senator John Corona, Republican of Dallas, has said that he is not going to weigh in. I know I did a good job with that one. He's not going to weigh in on who ought to win the lieutenant governor's race, but he and his wife are going to loan Dan Patrick their plane to go around the state campaigning because they believe that ideologically they are most aligned with Dan Patrick.
One of the backdrops for this is that Donald Huffines has announced a challenge to John Corona from the right. And
Corona's kind of backing the most right, or at least the candidate that sees himself as the most right in this race.
Well, and Patrick was going to do a fundraiser at Huffines' house, from what I understand. And after that, after the Corona thing popped up, after Huffines declared, Patrick backed out. So Corona's got his own politics here, too.
Well, it's interesting because one of the major issues that Corona and Patrick have not been aligned on in the past is whether or not they like Dan Patrick. Right?
Right.
Yeah.
And they famously hate each other and have had famous, very ugly personal spats in public.
Right, which seem to have be water under the bridge at this point, apparently.
Right. Just more proof that this is really high school with money.
Yeah. Here's how I apologize. Borrow my plane.
Any final poll thoughts before we do one last topic?
You know, people are still concerned in Texas about the border and immigration. It's really, really persistent. They still are worried about, you know, the national economy. And there's still, you know, this thing that Perry tapped years ago and is still living on, this antipathy toward Washington, is still really, really strong in Texas. So
that's something that has definitely caught on elsewhere, I think.
Well, Perry, if he's running for president again, hopes it stays caught on, I think.
As goes Texas, right? As goes the rest of the country.
Well, that gets to our next topic, sort of. You know, one of the big things about Texas policy right now is sort of where we're going on abortion, right? We're sort of making it much harder to get abortions. Do you think the rest of the country will follow that?
I think a lot of this is going to depend on what the Supreme Court decides to do. Obviously, what's happened in Texas is that originally a federal court in Austin overturned or held unconstitutional a provision in House Bill 2, which was the legislation in Texas that required doctors at abortion clinics in Texas to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles. That was a provision that was going to severely restrict the doctors who were the abortion clinics that were able to practice to operate in Texas. So a federal district court overturned it. That same measure went to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in Louisiana, which is a more conservative court, and they basically overruled the federal district court. And so now this whole debacle moves on to the Supreme Court to make some kind of decision on what's going to happen next. But, you know, you've seen these kinds of legislation, these kinds of bills have been moving in other states. They've been upheld in some states. They've been overturned in some states. So really, the jury, I think, is out on these types of abortion restrictions nationally.
Yeah, especially the, I mean, we've had Mississippi and several other states that have had that, the hospital admitting privileges, which was the key factor.
Well, and there have been court cases around other elements of this legislation that aren't even, you know, in the courts in Texas yet, which is the fetal pain provision of this legislation, around the use of drug-induced abortions. You know, so I think that we now have one major element moving through the court system, but hang on, because I bet in the next year we're
going
to see at least
two more cases. ACA hasn't been tried yet. Now, the drug-induced abortions was, and there was one provision that was declared unconstitutional. If the health of the woman was
in jeopardy,
then you could not enforce the, 10-year, 15-year-old FDA guidelines, which doctors say are no longer, and we heard testimony during the session, doctors say that that is no longer best practices, but the law requires them to go back to it anyway. But yeah, the ACA, which that's taking your clinic and upgrading the facilities to have it be like an ambulatory surgical center, which includes all the things that, you know, if you were going in for knee surgery or any kind of, you know, outpatient day surgery. That one, the requirement doesn't go into effect until
September
of 2014. So they haven't put that one through the courts yet, but that'll be another one that...
That will severely limit, you know, the number of abortion clinics that can even operate in Texas.
So this fight continues.
Yes.
But in the meantime,
for a very
least,
long time.
At least nine abortion clinics have shut down. Is that right?
Women's health clinics have stopped performing abortions as a result
of
this.
They haven't closed any clinics yet.
You know, I think closure is, it depends on the services that were provided there.
Right.
In some cases, if they were already providing, you know, breast exams, if they were already providing other, you know, cervical cancer screenings, they may still be in operation. But, you know, what Republican state lawmakers hope is that these clinics are getting so much of their revenue from performing abortions that they won't be able to stay in business if they can't perform abortions.
Some of them are saying right now we're staying open for the moment for those other patients, but they don't know what their future is.
Right.
They wouldn't be happy for them to stay open but just not perform abortions.
I think
not if it's Planned Parenthood.
If they're affiliated with Planned Parenthood, and if they operate any other clinics in Texas or elsewhere under the same sort of financial umbrella that do perform abortions, they would prefer that those clinics not exist.
Well, one thing that certainly does have to close is our time here today. So we'd like to thank Shiny Ribs for doing our music.
Did he just make an abortion analogy to end the podcast?
No.
I think if he did, we'll get some emails.
Did you?
I can't believe you would accuse me of such a thing.
FDA guidelines say we have to end this in about 30 minutes.
Right.
If you have questions or comments about Emily, send them to tribcast@texastribune.org. No, I was just saying, you know, things like the eighth wonder of the world, even...
He's trying to,
has to close.
Dig his way out of the hole right before we wrap up.
I'm trying to dig you out. What was I going to say? I was going to say thanks to Ben, Ross, and our producer, Todd. This is Reeve. And thank you to Emily, too.
I was going to say, I don't even get thanks. Jeez, the tides have turned.
Goodbye, everyone.
Downton Abbey has gone straight to hell.